Evolutionary Psychology, Part 1, The Science of Human Nature, Lecture 6, Food, Clothing, Shelter, and Health.
As we've seen, evolution by natural selection ultimately depends on differential survival and reproduction. Herbert Spencer's phrase, survival of the fittest, therefore captures only half of the requirements for natural selection. Reproduction is equally important. Indeed, if an organism survives, that is, it doesn't die and it isn't killed, but it does not reproduce, then whatever heritable characteristics it may have will disappear from its population when it eventually dies. For this reason, evolutionary biologists often say that an organism that doesn't reproduce is invisible to evolution by natural selection. However, there are some exceptions to this rule. For example, the non-reproductive members of a eusocial insect colony nevertheless contribute to the survival and reproduction of one or more of their siblings, the queen, with whom they share the majority of their genes. We will spend several lectures discussing the reproduction half of the survival and reproduction equation for natural selection. For this lecture, I would like to concentrate on those behavioral traits that, despite being less sexy, are nonetheless important aspects of evolution by natural selection. That is, finding and consuming nutritious food, accommodating to and in some cases resisting the effects of climate and weather, and avoiding or surviving predators and diseases. Animals have many anatomical, physiological, and behavioral adaptations for accomplishing these activities. Indeed, one thing that separates humans, and some of the great apes, from the other animals is that most of our adaptations for carrying out these activities are behavioral. Predators, that is, animals that kill and eat other animals, usually have anatomical adaptations for finding, killing, and consuming their prey. For example, African lions have acute senses of smell, hearing, and sight, all of which are highly adapted to locating potential prey. They have claws and teeth specialized for holding, puncturing, and tearing animal flesh, and even breaking large bones, and muscles tied to flexible skeletons that allow them to stalk, chase down, overpower, and kill large animals. And they have sophisticated social hunting behaviors that greatly increase the probability that they will successfully subdue and kill even prey animals, such as water buffalo, that are much larger themselves. The same sentences could be used to describe human predators, except that instead of the various anatomical and physiological traits of African lions, like acute senses of hearing and smell, claws, teeth, and so forth, humans have equally effective behavioral traits that allow them to find, subdue, and kill even larger prey. Even elephants are not immune to human predation. Furthermore, most of these behavioral adaptations are clearly learned, passed down as parts of the knowledge and skills that comprise the cultures of various peoples. And not only passed down, human information transfer via learning is horizontal as well as vertical. That is, humans can as easily pass on information and skills to their contemporaries as they can pass them to their offspring. Passing information within the same generation is often referred to as horizontal information transfer, with time visualized as a vertical axis, whereas passing information from one generation to the next, and especially from parents to offspring, is referred to as vertical information transfer. Humans can do both, which greatly increases the volume of information that can be transferred, the speed with which this happens, and the breadth over which the information can be disseminated. Once again, one of the most basic characteristics of human evolved psychological mechanisms is that what is inherited in a Darwinian sense is not the specific form of behaviors, but rather a tendency to learn certain types of behaviors much more easily than others, and in patterns that are often quite similar despite significant differences in the cultural environments in which such learning occurs. That said, there is strong evidence that we inherit innate tendencies to prefer certain types of foods based on their nutritional content. For example, given the opportunity to choose freely from a large variety of foods, most people, and especially children, prefer foods with relatively large amounts of sugars, fats, and salt, compared with foods high in plant fiber, soluble vitamins, and minerals. Indeed, the entire fast food industry is predicated on precisely this pattern of food preference. Although fast food outlets generally do offer healthy food choices, such as salads and grilled rather than breaded and deep-fried chicken, these items are requested in much smaller quantities and by many fewer customers than the high-sugar, high-fat, high-salt alternatives. So, why do we prefer high-sugar, high-fat, high-salt foods? Why do they taste so good? Because, in our evolutionary past, our ancestors who preferred these foods survived and reproduced more often than others who did not, or did not prefer them as much. Sugars are primary sources of metabolic energy for animals, especially during the developmental stages leading up to puberty. The nervous system in particular can only use sugars, specifically glucose, for energy. Furthermore, since primates have unusually large nervous systems for their body size, and because their lifestyle is primarily arboreal, requiring lots of energy for climbing, swinging, and so forth, primates have relatively high metabolic requirements compared with many other mammals. Therefore, any developing primate, including human children, who needs energy for cell division and the operation of a high-energy-requiring nervous system, and who preferentially eats high-sugar foods, would have a selective advantage over a child who did not have such a preference. Fats contain almost twice as much metabolic energy as sugars, and so consuming fats to fuel the rest of the body is also more efficient than consuming foods high in plant fiber, and therefore low in available energy content. Finally, sodium is essential to the normal function of animal cells, especially muscle cells and the cells of the nervous system. However, sodium is relatively rare in most terrestrial environments, as rainfall tends to leach it from soils and rocks into the oceans. Also, plants do not take up sodium. Indeed, sodium is toxic to most plants, and so a diet high in plant material will necessarily be low in sodium. Therefore, eating animals, as opposed to eating plants, and consuming salt whenever and wherever possible, would have been adaptive in environments in which sodium is rare and difficult to obtain, such as equatorial Africa, where billions of years of rainfall has leached most of the sodium from the soil, and where our evolutionary ancestors first evolved their particular metabolic requirements. To sum up, anyone who limited their intakes of sugars, fats, and salt when they were available would not have survived and reproduced as often as anyone who had no such limitation. Hence the widely recognized fact that you can't eat just one if a source of food is available that is high in sugar, fat, or salt, or ideally all three, most people will eat it until it's all gone. In an environment where such materials are rare, that is, our Pleistocene past, such behavior would have been strongly adaptive. In our current environment, such behavior leads eventually to serious health problems, such as diabetes, obesity, and high blood pressure, among others. However, since these diseases typically strike us down when we're older, natural selection cannot eliminate them, as anything that happens to us after we've reproduced is again invisible to natural selection. There's even a strong suggestion that natural selection in our primate past can explain the human preference for alcohol. Alcohol is toxic, and many animals will not consume foods that have any amount of alcohol in them. However, primates, and especially humans, tend to prefer foods that have small amounts of alcohol in them, especially fermented fruits. Indeed, this is the tip-off as to how this preference probably evolved, as ripe fruits often contain alcohol. This is because ripe fruits contain large amounts of sugar, which when it is fermented by yeasts on and in the tissues of the fruit, is converted into alcohol. Alcohol is also volatile and an excellent vehicle for disseminating volatile odorants into the air. Indeed, since fruits ripen as a way of attracting animals, who eat the fruits and disseminate the seeds, the plants that produce such fruits and the animals that seek them out and eat them constitute a coevolutionary spiral in which each increase in adaptiveness of one partner stimulates a corresponding increase in the other partner. All of these combine to make alcohol a marker for primates who have a higher than usual requirement for high-energy, sugar-containing foods. Once again, any primate who limited its intake of fermented fruit would have been selected against, compared with a primate who had no such limitation. Therefore, a liquor bar is to alcohol what a fast food restaurant is to high sugar, high fat, high salt foods, an opportunity for us to indulge what is essentially an unlimited and formerly adaptive desire, and of course for some of us, to make huge amounts of money as a result. So intense is selection on the basis of nutrition that the nutritional environment inside the womb can have profound effects on our behavioral and nutritional status later in life, and even in our children and grandchildren's lives. There is experimental evidence that mammals in general, and humans in particular, can have more than one metabolic set point, depending on our nutritional environment before birth. Individuals that develop inside mothers who are consistently starved of calories tend to have what is now known as a thrifty hungry metabolism. That is, they have lower metabolic rates and higher hunger set points, especially for sugars and fats, than individuals whose mothers were well fed. As a result, children of hungry mothers tend to be hungry themselves and show a significant tendency toward obesity in environments in which food is plentiful and unlimited. In mice, this switch to the thrifty hungry setting is now known to be heritable for several generations, resulting in mice that are significantly more likely to become obese if food is available. This may even be one of the explanations for the epidemic of obesity among Americans. Their mothers dieted during pregnancy, which switches on the thrifty hungry phenotype. Thrifty hungry mothers are then more likely to become obese and therefore more likely to also diet during pregnancy, thereby intensifying this phenomenon. Not all foods are tasty and nutritious. Some are worthless, and some are toxic and dangerous. Plants and fungi, like mushrooms, can't run away from animals that might eat them. Therefore, plants and fungi that have materials in their tissues that are toxic or distasteful to animals would not have been eaten as often as those that did not. Natural selection, in other words, tends to select for plants and fungi that contain toxic or distasteful materials, and especially for materials that would easily mark them as such. Because such materials are often present in non-animal foods, animals that eat plants are adapted to being able to identify potentially toxic or dangerous food sources. Cows, for example, will avoid eating most toxic plants unless they're starving, which is why pastures must be rotated periodically, as they tend to fill up with toxic or distasteful plants, including plants with thorns, over time. Humans and other primates and rats all exhibit a food preference behavior known as neophobia. That is, they avoid eating foods with which they are not familiar. This is particularly true among younger individuals who display a marked neophobia, especially to foods derived from plants and fungi. They will only sample new foods in small amounts, unmixed with other foods, what my family jokingly refers to as toxic food contact contamination. That way, if they're sickened by the new food, they can quickly learn to identify and avoid it, and foods that look like it or taste like it. This is why if a child gets sick, after eating a particular food, even if the sickness is not caused by the food, but rather by a virus, they will avoid eating that food from then on. This is why I can't eat pancakes, for example. I got sick once after eating pancakes when I was a kid. This also explains why we find the smell and appearance of spoiled foods particularly off-putting. Foods spoil because bacteria and fungi grow in them, especially if they remain at room temperature for extended periods of time. The bacteria and fungi that produce such spoilage are themselves adapted to producing volatile chemicals that identify them as such. This prevents them from being eaten as part of spoiled food because they make it smell and taste bad, and therefore they avoid being killed by the acid in the stomach of an organism that consumes them. Like plants, bacteria and fungi cannot avoid being eaten by running away. Therefore, they produce metabolic byproducts that make people who consume them sick, vomiting them back up and thereby preventing them from being digested. In response, individuals, and again especially children, are sensitive to the appearance, odor, and taste of spoiled food, and will avoid them if possible, thereby avoiding the negative consequences of ingesting potentially toxic materials produced by bacteria and fungi in the spoiled food. In fact, children are particularly prone to what could be called contagious vomiting. On a school bus, for example, if one child vomits, all the other children on that bus will probably vomit right away. Why? Well, because in our evolutionary past, when somebody ate something that was potentially toxic or spoiled and caused them to vomit, it was likely that everybody else in their group did the same thing. And so the fail-safe position is, if somebody vomits, everybody vomits. Which brings us to the subject of cooking, and especially to cooking with salt and spices. Cooking accomplishes three things. It makes foods, especially animal foods, more easily digestible. It kills bacteria and fungi, and it preserves food, at least until the food cools off. Cooking, of course, requires the ability to use fire, and therefore, if cooking food is adaptive, then this adds to the adaptive value of the ability to make and use fire, a trait unique to humans as far as we know. Indeed, humans are nearly unique among animals in that we're not terrified and repelled by fire. On the contrary, humans tend to be fascinated by fire and are attracted to it rather than repelled. There is archaeological evidence that humans have used fire for at least 300,000 years, and perhaps as long as 1.5 million years. Given this immense span of time, it is quite possible that this behavior is itself the result of natural selection. Those of our ancestors who were attracted rather than repelled by fire survived and reproduced as a result because of the multiple benefits derived from the use of fire, and therefore passed on their fascination and attraction to fire to us, their descendants. And, of course, a few of our domesticated animals, dogs and cats, share our proclivity for fire, but that is probably the result of selection as well. Since our ancestors lived with fire, the animals they domesticated would have been selected for their tolerance for fire by our ancestors. What about spices? Is there some adaptive reason for the fact that we use spices in cooking? The answer is apparently yes. Extensive research has shown that most spices are bactericides. They kill bacteria, or at least they inhibit their growth. Indeed, the most powerful antibacterial spices are onions, garlic, oregano, and allspice. The ingredients in chilies and curries, especially the hot spices like cumin and turmeric, are also strongly bactericidal. Indeed, there's a correlation between average ambient temperature and spiciness of foods, with spicier foods preferred in warmer climates. This is probably because warmer ambient temperatures encourage more rapid spoilage of foods, especially cooked meats, precisely the foods with the highest nutritional value for humans. However, spices are also used to hide the fact that foods have already spoiled. This would in turn imply that spicy foods could be potentially dangerous, as they might contain potentially toxic bacterial byproducts. Well, who would be most susceptible to such toxins? Children, whose bodies are smaller, whose stomach acid is not as strong, and whose livers have not yet been exposed to a wide variety of foodborne toxins, thereby strengthening their biochemical resistance. Every parent can attest to the fact that children are much less likely to prefer spicy foods, and this is particularly true for spicy foods composed of a mixture of different materials, especially cooked cream sauces, vegetables, and meats, which are most likely to contain toxins derived from plants and bacterial spoilage. In sum, therefore, our proclivities to choose certain foods and avoid others are almost certainly evolved adaptations that have the effect of maximizing nutritional value and minimizing risk. Food procurement, preparation, distribution, and consumption by humans are usually accomplished in a cultural milieu in which innate tendencies are coupled with and reinforced by individual and social learning. We've just seen how food preferences are strongly influenced by our evolutionary past. This is also the case for all of the steps in finding, procuring, processing, and consuming food. Both hunting and gathering are usually done in groups rather than alone. Hunting, in particular, is a social activity among both apes and humans. As is the case in other social carnivores, groups of hunting humans can use techniques that increase the probability of success, especially when hunting large game. As just one example, solitary hunters are usually obliged to sit and wait, whereas groups of hunters can drive game towards their partners waiting in ambush. Even gathering, especially in the context of agriculture, can often be enhanced by group cooperation as compared with working alone. Ethnographic evidence also points to group gathering as a social milieu in which females, the primary gatherers, can simultaneously assist each other in finding choice foods, such as fruits and tubers, which tend to be distributed in patches, while at the same time sorting out and strengthening their social relationships through conversation and reciprocal altruism. The same is also the case for group agriculture, in which communities, including men, women, and children, and even old people, participate in food production in ways that would not be possible for individuals working alone. Food distribution also occurs primarily in the context of group activity. This is especially true for meat, the product of hunting and of cooperative animal husbandry. Plant food sources are usually less concentrated and of lower nutritional value than meats and can often be preserved, whereas meats, especially when obtained from large animals, cannot be efficiently preserved and stored for later use by individuals. Therefore, when hunters obtain large prey, there are usually very elaborate and well-known rules for the distribution of such foods, often tied to the dominant structure of human groups. Once again, the ultimate reason for the existence of such rules and rituals is that they enhance the survival and reproduction of both the individuals that have them and the groups of which they are members. That is, we inherit the tendency to easily and efficiently learn and promote such food distribution rules and rituals because our ancestors survived and reproduced more often as a result of these same tendencies. Indeed, much of human social interaction involves food in some way, which is why in a previous lecture I pointed out only half facetiously that evolutionary psychology involves the frank discussion of subjects not usually considered polite at dinner. Now, enough about food. What about clothing? Well, clothing serves at least three functions in human cultures, all of which have evolutionary implications. In nearly all climates, clothing provides protection against the vagaries of climate and weather. Clothing also simultaneously conceals and reveals secondary sexual characteristics. clothing also serves as an indirect indication of social status, which is particularly noticeable and important in large social groups with intense dominance hierarchies. Humans generally need clothing because, unlike almost all other mammals, except whales, we lack sufficient fur and hair to provide insulation and protection. Even in environments in which insulation and protection are generally unnecessary, places like tropical forests, humans still wear some form of clothing, even if it only consists of strings, beads, and the like. Therefore, clothing has both a purely functional aspect, insulation and protection, and a social aspect. In both cases, natural selection has resulted in the evolution of learned abilities to fashion and use clothing, both for insulation and protection and for social interactions. That such abilities are innate rather than purely learned is testified to by the fact that they're pan-specific, that is, all human societies learn to do these things, and they conform to general rules that are related to the evolutionary functions of clothing. As just one example, consider shoulder pads. Shoulder pads in male clothing serve two functions. They provide protection from blows aimed at the upper body, and they enhance the shoulder-to-hip ratio. More about this in a later lecture, making their wearer appear more masculine. That the tendency to fashion and wear shoulder pads is probably the result of an evolved tendency is indicated by the fact that they've been reinvented multiple times in multiple cultures, and almost always in the same general context, male-male competition, both for status and for access to reproductive females. This even explains why shoulder pads have sometimes appeared in women's clothing. Such appearances have generally coincided with shifts in women's roles from domesticity to competition in the social milieus dominated by men. In effect, women use shoulder pads, usually unintentionally, as a way of indicating their status in male-dominated hierarchies and in female hierarchies that reflect male-dominance hierarchies. Shelter, like food and clothing, has significant evolutionary implications in humans. The tendency to occupy, and especially to build shelters, is a relatively uncommon trait among most animals. Once again, this is generally because most animals have anatomical and physiological adaptations that make the occupation and/or building of shelters unnecessary. Humans, by contrast, all either occupy natural shelters or build shelters that protect us from the extremes of our environment. Our ancient Pleistocene ancestors are often caricatured as cavemen, occupying shelters that they have not themselves constructed. While this may have been true for some of our ancestors, it is probably the case that our perception of how prevalent such behavior was among our ancestors is strongly biased by the fact that only in caves are such ancient remains preserved well enough for us to study and find them. Archaeologists 100,000 years from now might also conclude that we all lived in large concrete buildings with very thick walls, since only such buildings would survive long enough for our distant descendants to observe them. They wouldn't, in other words, know that we lived in houses made out of wood at all, and might conclude that we didn't. In other words, the vast majority of our evolutionary ancestors probably lived in shelters, consisting of the same perishable materials of which ours are constructed, wood and piles of stone, which eventually rot and are dispersed by natural forces, unless we maintain them. And, like clothing, our shelters also communicate our social status, as well as protect us from the elements. Cultural anthropology is filled with examples of houses and other buildings that both provide shelter to their inhabitants and provide strong signals as to the social position of their owners. Height is a crucial clue indicating social status among humans. Numerous studies have shown that taller people are more likely to rank higher in social groupings than shorter people. This tendency is also reflected in the details of buildings. People of higher social status tend to build and live in taller buildings, and especially in buildings in which the architectural details tend to indicate that their inhabitants are unusually tall. Everybody's familiar with buildings that have doors that are 12 or 15 or in some cases 20 feet high. We all know that people don't get that tall. But knowing that buildings with doors like that exist implies to us that maybe the people in there are that tall and therefore that much more impressive and effective than we are. And it's not accidental that social revolutions also involve leveling, that is, literally cutting people down to size, in a way that decreases the status distinctions between individuals in society. All of these common correlations between status and architecture are the result of an underlying adaptive algorithm that correlates perceptions of social status with differential survival and reproduction. Taller people live in taller shelters, command more resources, and therefore have relatively higher survival and reproductive rates than smaller people. This, in turn, is correlated with a noticeable trend in human physical evolution. People today are more than twice as tall as our distant evolutionary ancestors, and average human height continues to increase, probably as a result of selection for increased height. But, as the old saying goes, if you've got your health, you've got everything. Or, stated negatively, if you don't have your health, no amount of food, clothing, or fancy shelter can make up for its lack. Humans have many behaviors that enhance their health, both by increasing their physical health and limiting exposure to potential threats to health. For most of our evolutionary history, our ancestors were as likely to be prey to larger predators as to be predators on other animals. Consequently, we have inherited a suite of behaviors that minimize our potential exposure to predation, behaviors that we retain even though most of those predators are now either rare or extinct. For example, people are generally more comfortable in known surroundings than in strange ones. This is because in known surroundings, we generally know where it's safe and where it isn't. Such knowledge can come from personal experience, but is more often the result of teaching, especially by our parents and peers. We are particularly adept at learning what places to avoid, even to the point of paranoia. Remember those agency detectors, tuned to detect false positives? Primates in general, and humans in particular, have relatively poor night vision. In essence, we have traded visual sensitivity, especially in low light, for visual acuity, a distinct advantage for animals that live in trees and depend on ripe, brightly colored fruit for food. This makes us particularly vulnerable to predation at night, when our visual acuity is almost worthless. Hence, there is a strong tendency for humans to be generally fearful in low-light environments, in which our agency detectors tend to be working on overdrive. We also have a tendency to detect predators and other dangers where they don't actually exist, especially in low-light and in unfamiliar environments. That is, our ancestors who were frightened of the dark and therefore more alert, and who saw lions and tigers and bears lurking in every shadow and dark places, survived and reproduced more often than those that didn't, because sometimes there really were predators lurking about in those dark places. And finally, as we will see later, one large predator still regularly hunts, attacks, and kills humans. Other humans, both alone and in social groups. Predators weren't the only animals that threatened our ancestors. Poisonous spiders and snakes also provided an evolutionary force that has shaped our behavioral responses. Poisonous spiders and snakes do not have poisons to injure or kill people. They have them to kill smaller prey and to defend themselves against larger predators. Furthermore, most species of poisonous spiders and snakes live in the same habitats in which our evolutionary ancestors lived. Semi-tropical savannas with grasslands broken by scattered trees, in which our ancestors sheltered at night. Under such circumstances, those individuals that had an innate, unreasoning fear of spiders and snakes would have been less likely to be bitten by them and would therefore pass on those innate, unreasoning fears to their descendants. Such spider and snake phobias are so intense that we can easily see spiders and snakes in other things, crawling insects and wavy power cables on the floor, especially in darkened rooms or outdoors in low light. Diseases and parasites are inescapably associated with sociality. They are spread from host to host by contact, especially in dense social aggregations. This especially applies to diseases and parasites that are spread through physical contact, and especially to those spread via food and sex. We have already discussed the kinds of neophobias present in children. Adults also have evolved tendencies to avoid certain kinds of physical contact, especially if they could lead to the spread of disease. For example, people have strong negative reactions to both feces and vomit. Both can be vectors for the spread of disease, especially potentially fatal diseases such as cholera and typhoid. In other words, those of our ancestors that instinctively avoided contact with such things survived and reproduced more often than those who did not. In some cultures, the behavioral tendency to avoid contamination has led to the evolution of extraordinarily complex social adaptations. For example, there are extremely detailed prohibitions on contact with most bodily fluids in Japanese and other East Asian cultures, prohibitions that are specifically associated with the spread of certain fluid-borne pathogens. In India, the caste system is intimately tied to the social segregation of contact with potential pathogens, with untouchables relegated to the cleaning and processing of materials contaminated with human feces. Again, the tendency for such social structures to develop is tied to an underlying tendency to preferentially learn behaviors that have adaptive significance. Human phobias, especially those involved with exposure to potential predators, poisonous animals, and contamination by pathogens, are widespread and show correlations with particular environments, such as those in which such agents were endemic in our evolutionary past. By contrast, although many people today are injured or killed by knives, guns, and cars, not to mention electrical sockets, natural selection has not yet had sufficient time to shape our tendency to learn to avoid such potential threats. And so we've come almost to the end of the first part of this lecture series. The following lecture is about cooperation and the paradox of altruism. In it, we'll find out that cooperation, although extremely widespread, is a paradoxical process. Indeed, if one takes a strictly Darwinian viewpoint, cooperation shouldn't evolve at all. And so we'll have to figure out how it is that cooperation can get started and who it is that cooperates and why.
This ends Lecture 6. If you borrowed this course from a public library and would like your own copy of the course guide for future reference, call Recorded Books at 1-800-636-3399 and we'll send you a free copy. A shipping charge will apply.